KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, the uneasy alliance between the two actors' unions has turned into outright hostility. How did these brothers turn into Cain and Abel? And is such disorganized labor unique to Hollywood? Plus, the guilds want money from the digital future. But when will that future actually arrive? And finally, who gets credit before the credits roll? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Go nowhere, it's The Business from NPR. We begin with some rare good news on Tinseltown's labor scene. The Screen Actors Guild is still talking with Hollywood's producers. And last week, the two sides had made such progress towards a deal that they agreed to extend the bargaining to May 2nd. In the same breath, usually aggrieved AFTRA surprised the town by saying it had agreed, out of deference to its stepsister union SAG, to postpone their talks with producers until May 5th. And in related news, Tom admitted that he's always loved Jerry. Elsewhere, despite announcing a 21% hike in subscribers during a first quarter conference call, stock for the DVD rental service Netflix still managed to lose 21% of its value last week. What the hell happened? Even with record sales and profits, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings has warned of slowing growth and higher costs from its forthcoming online download business and from Blu-ray DVDs. To make up for those costs, Netflix will be charging Blu-ray renters a premium starting next year, because, as Hastings explained, quote, consumers are used to paying more for high-definition content. Of course, used to and willing to are two different matters. And a new Edelman Public Relations study released last week found that almost 40% of 18 to 34-year-olds are still not willing to pay for downloaded material. In plain English, that means they steal it. Speaking of which, the shining expectations of video game publisher Take-Two were a bit tarnished last week. Just 6 days before the release of their expected hit Grand Theft Auto 4, CNET reported that a truly grand theft might have occurred. A pirated copy of the Xbox 360 version of the game had already hit the internet. But it's an open question if theft's theft will steal its thunder. According to Variety's Ben Fritz, Take-Two had already predicted sales figures based on how many units retailers had ordered. Their early estimate? Opening week sales for Grand Theft Auto 4 were on track to gross $400 million, which would make it the biggest video game launch ever. Hell, that would make it the biggest movie opening ever, topping the $381 million Spider-Man 3 earned in its worldwide opening weekend. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up next, why can't SAG and AFTRA just get along? For as long as anyone can remember, there's been a simmering hatred between factions of Hollywood's two actors' unions. And yet, for decades, they've managed to hold their noses long enough to negotiate contracts together. But earlier this month, their détente deteriorated. And as we speak, SAG is bargaining alone with producers on a new contract for the first time since 1981. AFTRA will begin negotiations on May 5th. The breakup was ostensibly caused by an incident involving the venerable soap opera The Bold and the Beautiful. B&B cast members claim the show's been making more and more money internationally. They wanted a bigger cut of those euros than they're actually entitled to under their AFTRA contract. So they talked with SAG officials. But who approached who depends on who you talk to.
They came to SAG.
Actor Justine Bateman is a SAG board member, though her opinions here don't necessarily represent the unions.
And said, is there anything you can do here? We hate working this AFTRA contract.
Hooey.
Roberta Reardon is national president of AFTRA.
It's very disingenuous of them to say, oh, well, we didn't poach it. We didn't go to them.
Now, why would either union do anything to rock the boat just before a critical negotiation? Well, one or both of the unions may have wanted an excuse to break away from the other. Some say SAG wants to kill off AFTRA, and leaving the smaller union to fend for itself with producers would further render it irrelevant. Roberta Reardon.
It's been a concentrated effort to diminish AFTRA's standing with their own members. And this whole last year, there's been nothing but a drumbeat of defamation of AFTRA.
Do you think SAG wants to kill AFTRA?
Well, it certainly feels like it.
Others suggest that AFTRA wanted to go it alone so they could undercut SAG with a cheaper contract that would help them sign more production. Justine Bateman.
Right after we finish our negotiations, they're going to come right in and say, we'll do it for $10 less, whatever you want. That's what they have done traditionally, and that's what they'll keep doing. They're just Walmarting all the actors.
Now, we don't want to make Rashomon here, but we did want to make a point. Every disagreement between SAG and AFTRA seems to be this implacable, and is made more so by the rancorous and personal tone of the debate. But whatever the facts of the Bold and the Beautiful incident in particular, there's something everyone can agree on. Actor Jamie Cromwell has been active in both SAG and AFTRA politics.
It's the last card on the stack. And, of course, the stack was unbalanced. And this was the last card that was added, and the whole house fell to pieces.
We wanted to see what was wrong with the foundation of this house that allowed things to get to this point. First, we have to acknowledge that the kind of people who run for these kind of volunteer union positions can be a little emotional. Anyone who's dealt with their condo board knows what I'm talking about. Second, all unions run on passion, and that passion can create better working conditions, or it can go horribly wrong. Lois Gray is professor emeritus at Cornell School of Industrial and Labor Relations.
It's like a hornet's nest you're into. There's an emotionality and a kind of super loyalty, and when the rivalry becomes very intense between two organizations, these things happen.
Of course, show business just takes this ball and runs with it.
That's a Hollywood style. Everything is dramatic and dramatically exaggerated.
But one other factor unique to Hollywood is really the heart of the problem.
Well, there aren't any other examples of two unions having overlapping memberships. There are instances which two unions are trying to represent the same constituency, but there aren't any other instances in other industries where two unions have members who belong to more than one union.
By the 1930s, there were two centers of show business. Radio shows came from New York, and the movies came from Hollywood. And naturally, there were two actors' unions, AFRA, the American Federation of Radio Artists, and the Screen Actors Guild. They started talking about a merger as early as 1948, and if they'd done a little more than talk, they could have prevented a lot of problems. Because in 1952, something happened which brought those problems home to roost. Roberta Reardon of AFTRA.
There was a group called the TVA, which is the Television Authority, that was folded into AFTRA, and the T was added to AFTRA, so it's the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.
By default, the unions had become defined in terms of technology. TV and radio was taped or live, and movies were shot on film. And that would come back to bite them. As the years passed, the technologies used by film and TV began to blur, and so did the distinction between the companies that made them. By the end of the 70s, media consolidation meant that SAG and AFTRA were bargaining with pretty much the same companies. So, in 1981, they agreed to bargain collectively. It seemed like the next step would be a merger, but serious attempts as recently as just 5 years ago ran afoul because of issues that have existed since back in the day. Lois Gray of Cornell's Labor Relations School was a researcher for merger talks in 1960.
One main issue was structure. One has local unions, that's AFTRA, and the other is a national union. And another issue is the pension and welfare plan is different for each.
Roberta Reardon.
There was a great deal of fear whipped up about the health and retirement, pension and health systems. How would they merge or be administered? But I think a lot of people were made fearful about that, and that's really unfortunate.
The last reason was a difference in definition of who is an actor and who should be in a union together.
Actress Justine Bateman.
You know, these people are... They're a union of broadcasters and radio personalities and talk show hosts. We don't need to have everybody who's ever going to put their face in front of a camera or have their voice recorded for a radio show in SAG. They can have their union, we'll have ours, no problem.
Except there are two unions, and there are 40,000 actors who are in both. And though they pay dues to both, they sometimes get benefits from neither.
When you split the earned dollars, it's possible for you to earn a fine living that year, and then, but not qualify for health insurance in either union.
So a merger seems to make sense. but not to everyone.
I don't know that that's a solution, because it's inviting the rapist to just come in and live with you. I mean, I don't know how that's going to help things. I'd rather make sure the rapist cannot enter the state in which I live.
In 1999, only 46% of the needed 60% of SAG members agreed to a merger proposal. But by 2003, it was a narrow 57.8% of the needed 60. Many of the 1,200 people who voted against the merger that year were extras, who joined SAG when the union absorbed the Screen Extras Guild in 1992. Lois Gray of Cornell.
They feared that by bringing in AFTRA, which had open admissions, they'd have even more competition for jobs.
So you get a sense of all the myriad factors that have caused the bad blood between SAG and AFTRA. Still, they desperately need a peacemaker. Digital technology has rendered the old organizing principles of the two unions, SAG, film, AFTRA, tape, essentially moot. Many TV shows are now shot on film. And lots of indie movies are made on digital video, not tape. On the sofa side of the TV screen, the host of Survivor, Oprah, and the stars of CSI Miami all seem pretty much the same. So while their unions squabble on, a whole raft of real actorly issues go unaddressed. For instance, actors still only get pennies on the dollar of the billions in home video revenues that power the whole industry. And Americans spent $1.7 billion on video games last month. But little to none of the acting that's done in those games is represented by SAG. And then there's the thorny issue of how to get compensated for all that stuff that gets watched on the web. What happens next in this soap opera? Stay tuned for the next episode of The SAG and the AFTRA. In the past, Hollywood's guilds made terribly naive deals on fledgling technologies like cable and DVD that would become enormous moneymakers for the producers. This time around, as the song says, they say they won't get fooled again. The WGA, the DGA, and now SAG are bargaining hard to get their rightful piece of the digital pie. But it's hard to know how big a piece to demand when the pie isn't even out of the oven and no one knows how the pie will be paid for. To torture this analogy further, we've been hearing about one of the pie's ingredients for years. A magical box that will combine your cable TV, your DVD player, your stereo, your CD tower, your DVD collection, and your iPod, and send all that fabulous, delicious entertainment to any device in the house. One setup, one monthly bill, and, please God, one remote control. To find out why the future is taking so long to get here, and when it might actually arrive, our producer Matt Holtzman talked to Mike McGuire, who researches these things for the advisory services at Gartner, a technology consulting firm.
Mike McGuire, welcome to The Business.
Thanks.
So how long have we been talking about this shining digital convergence of the future? How long has it been kind of around as an idea?
Yeah, I can't cite the first instance, but it seems to me like I've been talking about this or being asked about it for at least the last 10 years.
The question is, right now, as we stand, do we have the technology to do this thing?
I would probably say we've got the piece parts of it. They're at various states of maturity. I would say we're probably at least 3 or 4 years away from anything approaching kind of what's been described.
Is there enough infrastructure? Is there enough pipe? Do enough people have broadband to make this thing work?
Well, it depends on, you know, if we're talking about the mass market, you know, we're still, I think if you look at most folks in there, the way they project things, we're talking maybe 60-65% of the U.S. population has broadband capabilities. You know, depending on what we think is required there, I think there's probably enough pipe there in terms of bandwidth. I think one of the other things we have to consider also is that the amount of content that's out there is you know, there is a lot of content, especially if you look at YouTube, right? But in terms of the things you and I might want to see in that box that would make us pay for it and pay for the service, like first-run movies.
Right.
You know, we're probably going to be away from that, and it's not a technology issue. It's a licensing issue in the way contracts are drawn up.
It does seem that the content providers have been really reticent to play ball in this area, even though with a really functional set-top box, they would probably sell more, seems to me, but they're concerned about what? Piracy and who's going to make what money? And
well, piracy is an issue. Who gets which cut of what is there? Also, let's face it, you know, people have talked a lot about advertising, supporting a lot of these models and a lot of these content distribution ideas. But at the heart of it, too, is they're trying to also preserve some of their existing what are called the windowing distribution windows, right? Like theatrical, pay-per-view, et cetera.
It comes out in the theater first.
Right.
Then it goes to home video. Then it goes to cable. Then it goes to regular TV.
And a lot of those are still very significant contributors, especially for the studios and the networks, right? So it's kind of this, it's how do they balance this out and make these transitions similar to the music industry, right? It's very easy to say, look, digital is growing great, digital distribution. Even the legitimate versions of that are growing well. But it's also very difficult to then say, walk away from the CD, when that's still, you know, a significant part, or if not the dominant part of their revenue right now, even though it's declining.
It does seem to me that there is such turmoil in terms of the companies that might be vying to be a part of this simple box. You have technology companies that make boxes. You have telecommunications companies that have the pipes. You've got the distribution companies. You've got the media conglomerates and the studios who make the content. None of them know who's going to own what and who's going to make what and who's going to be in control of what. Is that kind of free-for-all part of why we're not progressing, even though we might have the technology and the infrastructure to do it?
One of the real challenges that your question kind of gets at is, who controls the consumer? Who owns that relationship with the individual who's actually going to pay for this stuff, either the box or the content, either with their eyeballs, without advertising, or out of their pocket with subscription fees? That owner then becomes the gatekeeper and the bank, if you will, right? Paying everybody else out of that.
Ooh, scary.
It's a very scary proposition, right? But in the end, to a large degree, actually, that's essentially what I think a lot of consumers want, right, is ease or minimize the number of points in the chain where I have to pull out my credit card or enter it somewhere to pay for this stuff. As I said, as more demand comes up, you'll see the marketplace will work itself out in terms of the solutions that get there and get presented to consumers that map to that or deliver that kind of unified experience everybody's looking for.
All right, well, you say everyone's looking for it, but that may be part of the issue. Is everyone looking for it?
That's a very good question, because you and I may spend a lot of time looking at these technologies and the way content gets delivered, and it's fascinating, right?
Yeah.
On the other hand, I think to a large majority of consumers out there in the world, they look at this and say, you know what? That's just different. It's not necessarily better for me.
Now, let's just talk about one more thing, and kind of a surprise entry in this conversation, that is the PlayStation 3, which is you know, an HD DVD player, and it's a game station, and it can hook up to the internet. So in a way, it's probably the most simple to use integrated media box that's out there. And you don't even think of it that way. You think of it as a game box.
I mean, which brings us to an interesting spot. I think if we look across kind of the different demographics or age groups, you know, a so-called digital native, somebody who grew up with the internet and computers, may be much more willing to look at something like the PlayStation, as you describe, or the Xbox, as that thing that they desire to have in their living room.
Well, it sounds like then the answer is, when does the single set-top digitally converged box arrive, is when the current native digital generation grows up and creates a need for it.
I think you're right. That when you reach that, those folks grow up and they become the dominant part of the marketplace, then there are things that, you know, become very interesting in terms of achieving that kind of unified box, if you will. But on the other hand, I think analysts should never say on the other hand, but what's likely is more as likely to happen is there's going to be this constant progression of things. So I think, you know, do we ever get at this nirvana-like single box, or is it just going to be a constant evolution of things that take on different tasks?
Mike McGuire is Vice President of Research for the Media Industry Advisory Services at Gartner in San Jose, California. Mike, thanks for expounding your wisdom here on The Business.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up after a short break, Hollywood companies get carded. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The theater lights dim, the music comes up, but even before the opening credits, the logos for a lot of companies roll by on what are called cards. Our producer Matt Holtzman recently took in the new kung fu action fantasy flick Forbidden Kingdom and noticed there were 5 of these cards. And he wondered, who are these companies? What do they do to get such prominent credit? To find out, he hunted down Casey Silver, the producer of Forbidden Kingdom.
Casey Silver, thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Pleasure.
So at the beginning of your new movie, The Forbidden Kingdom, there's this amazing scene of the Monkey King and his magic staff, and he's jumping from mountaintop to mountaintop and fighting the Jade Army, and it's just amazing. But even more amazing is, as the movie then gets started, there are a series of names of companies that appear on the screen. And I wanted to go through the names of those companies to talk about who they are and what part they played in bringing the Forbidden Kingdom to the screen. And just to list them very quickly, Lionsgate, we've got the Weinstein Company, we've got you, Casey Silver Productions, we've got Relativity Media, and we've got the Y.E. Brothers. So tell me, perhaps in order of how they got involved in the film, I assume that you're the first person.
I got the, I developed a screenplay, got the actors together, and Relativity Media convinced me that they had the wherewithal to finance the movie and do it properly. And so we made offers to the actors committed to do the movie. We got Rob Minkoff in, and
that's
we budgeted the movie.
That's
director.
The director. Right.
And we then budgeted the movie, and the most aggressive and ardent pursuers of the movie were Lionsgate. So I made a deal with Lionsgate.
Okay, so Lionsgate says, you make this movie, and we'll distribute it. We'll get it out to theaters. Okay.
Yes, so they make a deal for domestic distribution, North American distribution. They also bought some foreign territories.
Right.
Harvey Weinstein was also very enthusiastic about the potential of the movie, and he bought some foreign territories. He bought Latin America, Spain, and France, and also, I think, made a deal with Lionsgate after Lionsgate controlled North America to be Lionsgate's 50% partner, sort of silent partner in the U.S.,
Okay, and then the Y.E. Brothers.
And when you shoot in China, it's a complicated arrangement, and the way to get permits and to sort of cut through it all the best way, it seemed to me, was to get a Chinese distributor financier. And so we sold Chinese rights to the Y.E. Brothers, and the Y.E. Brothers is a up-and-coming, a very aggressive company. They've been very good to deal with, of course. The people who run the company, neither of them are named Y.E. They're actually, I think the family name is Wang, but nonetheless.
Okay.
So that's how all of those names got on the opening credit.
All right. So now, are the names as they roll, are they chronological? Are they basically as people got involved in the film, or are they arranged by what?
Contractual obligation. You know, Lionsgate is the distributor in North America. So they then made a deal with the Weinstein Company thereafter. So the Weinstein Company gets a card. And after that, my deal with Relativity, everybody understood that the distributor would go first, and then I would go, and then Relativity would go, and then finally the last person who... last piece of the puzzle was the Chinese distributor Y.E., and they accepted being last. In China, I think they'll be first.
So are you saying there's two issues here? There's one of contractual obligation and there's one of ego.
I don't really think it was so much ego. I think it was, it is the standard and practice of Hollywood for the distributor, in this case Lionsgate, to go first. It is a little bit out of the ordinary to have a second distributor, but because Harvey was so enthusiastic about getting involved, he, as I say, bought these foreign territories and bought half of Lionsgate's domestic action. It seemed appropriate to allow for those guys to have a logo at the beginning of the movie. And Relativity and Y.E., again, I think it's a standard in practice of the industry after that. for those guys to come in and get their cards.
All right, but what I'm getting at, and ego was probably the wrong word, but you've used two phrases here. One is standard, kind of a standard way of doing business, but also you said you thought it was appropriate. So what I'm saying, and what I'm trying to get at, I think, is there a situation where you, as the producer, could decide, and I'm assuming that you have the final say as to how they go as the original producer. Is that correct?
It is, but, you know, as you start making deals with people, you say, okay, part of the Lionsgate deal is, yes, here are the terms, the financial terms and the guarantees for distribution in the U.S., and we're going to get a first logo, and we would like to be the first company to present the movie. And I say, sure.
Now, typically, very small movies would have very few cards, and often very big movies have very few cards, you know, Paramount Pictures. But it seems like these movies that come somewhere in the middle, and certainly movies that have foreign partners, would have a lot more cards because there's a lot more people involved in the making of the movie, or at least getting it to the screen.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to generalize, but I think that's a fair observation. I mean, when you go through financing movies independently, it's not one-stop shopping, where... Warner Brothers presents, or Disney presents, or Universal presents, and part of each negotiation is, you're right, people want to have their names on the screen. In this case, I didn't think it was excessive, but there are, you know, these five stakeholders.
Oh, I don't think it's excessive at all. I've seen many more, and it sounds like in this case that each of these partners did play a major role, though there's not somebody else that's there as kind of a vanity pain to say, oh, gee, we couldn't have made the movie without you. You didn't really do anything, but we couldn't have made the movie without you. We'll put a card up. It sounds like each of these five people, or these five organizations, had a very big part in getting the film to the screen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's largely true. I think that they all made, you know, I think that Lionsgate, in particular domestic, really did all the heavy lifting. YE obviously is an integral part because you need Chinese cooperation and a sort of shorthand over there to operate and operate successfully. And Relativity was there at the very beginning, finding, you know, getting the money together to make all those offers. So all of those people, I think, were really integral to getting it off.
Did you ever think when you started making movies that it was going to get this complicated? It seems really amazing that a movie gets to the screen at all.
Well, I mean, I guess I still believe in the primacy of a good idea for a movie, and that there's got to be some kind of fundamental financial reality for making the best. And, yeah, it can be, you know, some of them are simpler, some of them are more difficult, but I think that it's always challenging. You make little movies are challenging, as challenging in my experience as big movies. Working at the studio in many ways is simpler, but that arrangement presents different challenges. So, you know, I don't think that there's a simple observation that I can make that cuts right to a generalization that is accurate.
Casey Silver is the producer of The Forbidden Kingdom. It opened in theaters on the 18th. It will be in theaters nationwide and around the world. Casey, thanks for joining us on The Business.
A great pleasure, sir.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.